So today I will be using as reference material a couple texts. One is the method of no method, the Chan practice of silent illumination by Chan Master Shen Yun. And then the other one is the Zen teaching of Instantaneous Awakening by Master Hui Hai, Chinese. I was looking to see when he was, what was his era, but I'll have to find it and let you know a little later. And then, of course, we'll have words from Dogen. A day without Dogen isn't a day. Need Dogen, you know. So today I'm going to talk about practice in everyday life. When reading the sutras and other teachings of the Zen masters, often the settings are monastic settings. And being a person who practices in non-residential setting, I think it's very important that we, you know, make that transition. You know, can these also apply to life as practitioners in a non-residential setting? Of course, here at Jikoji, there are some people who are very fortunate and practice with residential, having that residential experience, but still go out into the world of everyday ordinary life of whatever we've got going on here in America these days. It's pretty different. Anyway, that's a little, sorry about the editorial. What I wanted to refer to is that in Japan, for example, one of the practices that is prevalent there as well as in other Asian countries is the practice of alms begging. And you know, this practice is a way that they obtain sustenance for their daily life, and it's an opportunity for the community to give and for the monk to receive. It's the norm. It's acceptable in Japan. However, in places like China, there's no tradition for alms begging. And practitioners had to work to sustain themselves. So it's for this reason that Chan has emphasized work practice very early on. In fact, even before Bodhidharma arrived in like 565 into China, there was a mix of work practice with meditation. And by the fourth and fifth patriarchs, self-supporting communities had sprung up, but there were only a few of them. In the 8th century, this is the period of Hui Neng, the sixth ancestor or patriarch, and some of you may know the story about him, but he actually was the person who was milling rice in the kitchen. That was his job. And there's little mention of him actually sitting in meditation in with the rest of the monks. And then after he was enlightened, he did go out of the monastery and for, I believe, over 20 years, 20 or 30 years, practiced out in the community. And he lived among hunters. And it's my understanding he help them with their traps. So by the 9th century, we have Master Baijiang, and he is the person associated with the saying that a day without work is a day without food. So you can see by now, work practice is fully entrenched in chan practice. And what we saw happening was the summer season, most of the monks would be getting up very early to practice meditation, go into the fields and cultivate the gardens, and at the end of the day return back into meditation. So they worked in the summer months, but by the time the winter came around, the land was frozen, and so there was no cultivation in the practice of these 3-month intensives emerged, where a master Baijiang gave talks, and we now see today in Chan as well as in Zen these extended and intensive practice periods. So work is everywhere, and here in America particularly, in the way the sanghas are developing across America, we see many small sanghas springing up. And typically, we have some centers such as Jikoji, which offers some residential, but mostly on the west coast and on the east coast are where the monasteries are, with, I think, Rumunji, and there might be one or two that are in the central part of the United States. So that means that there are some implications here for us. We have to find a way in our structure, or the way we're organizing here in America, our Buddhist practices, that they're relevant and we're able to somehow carry forth and sustain ourselves out in the community. There's a story from Zen master Sheng Yan that one of his students, who was an accountant in everyday life, joined the center and was assigned the task of being the accountant. She was quite upset. She says, you know, here I've come to get some real practice time in, and here I am counting money again. She was unhappy about that. And the Zen master said, well, you know, now that you've come to practice, it's different. You've come here with a different state of mind. And your attitude is different. And that you now are practicing being an accountant with a calm mind. And in addition to that, the practice of being an accountant is for the benefit of all beings. And it's for the benefit of the Sangha. It's no longer just for yourself, which is one way that she may have perceived her role prior to coming into the center and started her practice. In addition, the statement is that there was no harm in what she was doing. Now, that might have held true also when she was out in the community. There are certainly, as practitioners, we do know about right livelihood, one of the Noble Eightfold Path practices. So, right livelihood. So I've been thinking about what constitutes practice in of course livelihood, and I'm sure each of you come to Jikoji with some ideas about practice in the community and then practice here at Jikoji. So I think making, offering our abilities, so what we have, we bring to the Sangha, is fundamental to this practice of sustaining ourselves we sustain ourselves outside of the center, but then can bring our abilities and what we have to offer to the community, whether it's a small practice group or a retreat center like we have here at Jokoji. So people need to practice together. Practicing together brings us strength and companionship. We come here to deepen our practice and renew ourselves. In addition, there are some very critical reasons why I believe we need these practice groups and centers like this. I think first off, what's really important is that we have a group of people who have a shared mindset. People who you can talk about your practice with one another. You have shared experiences. Often students come to me and say that they can't talk to anybody about what they're doing in their practice. It's outside the realm of their family members and friends. You know, they don't understand what Zen practice is. Some people think it's witchcraft. You know, some people have very distorted views of what Buddhism is, because here in America we have a Christian, Judeo-Christian foundation, although you know a lot of this is changing now with the mix of immigrants coming with different traditions. I guess the point is that when you come to this kind of place or to a weekly sitting group, it's a time that you can manifest your true self and express your feelings about your practice openly. Secondly, this coming together presents the solidification of the values that we have as practitioners, and can reinforce that so that when you go out into the community, you are able to go forth with a stable mind and a positive reinforcement of a community behind you, that you can recognize that you're practicing with all beings. And the living embodiment of that is the Sangha, where you practice. So practicing at work has its own challenges. Sometimes the environments are, you know, a little less conducive to keeping a stable mind. But nevertheless, for you as a practitioner, bringing your stability of mind to those interactions with others is really definitely practicing at work. Zen Master Shengyin talks about silent illumination at work. And he describes this as putting the mind and body to the task at hand, so that you begin first by applying the best method in approaching your work. You would plan and take into account the past and the future. But when you actually do the activity, you would be present with it. You bring a focused mind and a centered mind, one that is settled and without distractions, without this pulling one way or the other, this thinking of good or bad, right or wrong, constantly caught in some kind of distinguishing of this and that, and instead of being settled as you approach your task. When you are settled and approaching your task, you do it wholeheartedly with an ordinary mind. And then when you complete your task, you step back and reflect upon it. How did that go? Are there changes I could have made or should make? Or are there things that maybe I would do differently to improve it? So it's with more of the practice of mindfulness that you approach the before and after of your task. You assess, too, whether the job was done well. So this practicing of silent illumination at work can be done in any activity. So the silence is not generating any kind of negative thoughts, engaging in distractions or afflicted emotions while you're carrying out the activity. The illumination manifests when you clearly understand the activity and you focus on carrying it out to completion. So, as practitioners, we should know our abilities, our limitations. And that helps us in our roles in society as well. We also can see, if we know our limitations, what are the boundaries? Can we decipher that? So you can see how approaching any activity with an even and stable mind will allow that assessment of that situation to come up in an appropriate way, because you're not caught in discriminations or this and that, or afflicted emotions of something pulling you one way or the other. You can imagine when, also in working with others, that if a person is very detail-oriented, and maybe you tend to be spacious about the way you approach life, then you may find that knowing limitations, knowing abilities, you'll find the middle way through any obstructions that might arise. Otherwise, we all know the other side of that. Frustration, discontent, confusion. So you can see how practicing silent illumination at work can influence others and your environment. Our Zazen practice supports us in everyday life. Zen Master Hui Hai speaks to where the mind settles and dwells. He says the mind should settle upon non-dwelling and there dwell. Non-dwelling. So what's non-dwelling? It means Excuse me a second. I'm experiencing change of season. So what is non-dwelling? It means not allowing the mind to dwell anywhere and upon anything whatsoever. Dwelling means upon nothing, means the mind is not fixed upon good or evil, non-being and being, inside or outside, or somewhere in between the two. Non-dwelling minds are Buddha minds. Does non-dwelling sound like something familiar to you? Non-thinking? Dogen's non-thinking? Non-dwelling. So think of non-dwelling and non-thinking. It's probably very similar. So non-dwelling is not allowing the mind to dwell upon anything whatsoever. Non-thinking. Non-thinking. There's also a group of practices called the Six Paramitas, or Six Perfections. And those are tools for bodhisattvas, practitioners, to use in everyday life. Those are typically referred to as generosity, ethical discipline, patience, enthusiastic effort, concentration, and wisdom. You've probably all heard that the practice of generosity is the precursor of all the other paramitas, and that in fact it's the foundation of all the other practices or perfections. So in its mundane aspect, in other words, if you haven't actualized it in emptiness, then we would say that this particular practice has to do with to giving freely, you know, not holding back, and also with some sense of acknowledging, you know, the need in another. This definition of dana paramita, or generosity, appears to be quite outer directed. So it isn't as much about the gift. That's not what's important. It really has to do with what's going on in your mind and the critical point is about grasping. And so the transformation of that grasping into the spirit of non-clinging is really moving towards, on the continuum, towards experience the perfection of it. So I came across another use of this, or definition of dana paramita, and it's defined as relinquishment of the dualism of opposites. Seems more inner directed than, you know, the idea that we have, or I had, about generosity being more, you know, outer directed. Of course, there is some, you know, inner work that's being done with the paramita, but here it seems like, all right, we've just leaped ahead a little bit more into this continuum, and now we have paramita, dana paramita, being defined as relinquishment of the dualism of opposites. So That could also include the relinquishment of all defilements. So defilements, you know, are well known to all of us. I mean, in a sense that we experience how our deluded thoughts, our grasping, our delusion about our ideas and the way we think the world is, all creates a suffering. And when we think we're right, and somebody is wrong, we have entered the dualism of opposites. And so how to proceed is really to relinquish holding to those views at each end. So, of course, this can apply to, you know, the way our minds work in so many ways, because we're always thinking something is good or bad, right or wrong, up or down, you know, critical and or not. You know, it's endless. If we all have our favorite, here we go again, we all have our favorite ways we interpret reality. We have our own dualistic splits. So this practice is to help you learn what yours are. It might be different than the person next to you. So if you know about that, when you see it arise, whether you're at home or work or driving in the car, that might trigger a dualistic split, you know, dealing with the traffic. Somebody just skipped right in front of you, nearly cut you off. It's your reaction. You'll see it's a dualistic split. Yes.
A funny dualistic split I recognize on the road is that anyone going faster than you is a maniac, and anyone going slower than you is an idiot.
Oh, it's that precious.
I'm just kidding, of course.
Yeah, yeah, no. But, you know, this is what we do. We have this labeling, you know, that's very fundamental in our aspects of mind. And, you know, when we start the labeling process, you know, we just kind of spin off and go down a mind stream.
Isn't that really the essence of the defilement and why it's a defilement? And that just occurred to me while we were talking. It's taking a position, I'm right, you're wrong, whatever. Taking a position, but being heavily identified with that position is me. That's where you get screwed up. Of course, you have to evaluate people and
yes.
things. You don't. It's not your place to judge them, but you do have to evaluate them. You have to work with it. But it seems that the error comes from you. Just too narrow-minded about it, and so identified with that. So instead of, you can still stand back. I mean, I've even done this after having a few glasses of wine. Oh, I can just stand back and. I know I'm right, but I'm just looking at, it doesn't matter to me. I could care less about it. But yes, I see the thing. Mm. Something closer mm-hmm. to that.
Yes. Yes, it's where the eye, it does.
Because
it is.
Whatever
right.
reinforces mm-hmm. the false sense of self, which is really that when Buddha says that there is no self, I'm convinced now he meant there is no ego self. That's an illusion, because it is an illusion. There's other stuff that's a little subtler and deeper. But they just say, oh, there's no soul. There's no ego.
Right. Well, it's the attachment to that I that gets us into trouble. You need your ego, actually, to function in everyday world, but it's the attachment to it, that you hold on to it and think it's you, and you identify that it's you moment by moment by moment, and then you've constructed your reality with.
That's clean, for sure.
Definitely. Bingo. Yes. John. That's right.
I think this really touches a hot button of nerve in Buddhism. It goes back a long time, like the first three or four councils all about this subject. Mm-hmm. There were a group of monks that wanted to do this. And these guys over here said, no, that's not right. That's wrong. And had a battle. They couldn't solve it, so they called the council. Some of the councils were successful, and some of them weren't, and they split up into different sects. So it's a long process we're dealing with. It's kind of the shadow side of Buddhism.
Well, I have a teaching here from Dogen on just this subject, right or wrong. So let's see what Dogen has to say. But first, major need here. I'm on the 12th link, aging. Okay, neither right nor wrong. The bright clarity of the ancestor's teacher's mind is the bright clarity of the 100 grass tips. With others, it is never one. With the self, it is never different. If you are only right, you are offending someone to their face. If you are only not right, where can you escape or hide? Therefore, it is said, be neither right nor wrong, neither attached nor separate. All the Tathagatas in the three times alike proclaim this truth. All the ancestral teachers together transmit this wonder. I dare to ask. I dare to question the great assembly. Tell me, what does this mean? After a pause, Dogen said, freely play the single iron flute. Unless you know its sound, we cannot listen together. Any questions on that one? So this single flute doesn't have any holes, you know, so it just, you know, in the, it's a kind of a lead pipe, huh? So what would be the sounds that he's talking about when he says, freely play the single iron flute. Unless you know its sound, we cannot listen together. What is the sound he's referring to? The sound we share. What do we share? How are we one? We share oneness. And that's where we can all play together. It is a teaching that I think helps us to, when we drop into emptiness, we can escape the delusion of right or wrong, because it's there where there's no differentiation. It's sameness, it's oneness, and it's there for all of us, every one of us. I have time for another one. You ready for another Dogen? Okay. Do you have that one? Okay. Let's see. All right. Here, this one's called the sitting on the ground of prajna, wisdom. There is no place the great way of the Buddha ancestors does not pervade, and a thing that is not endowed with it. However, only people who have the seeds of prajna planted in past lives can patiently sustain it. Therefore, it is said, do not see in terms of shapes. Do not seek in terms of sounds. The wind is still in the great thousands of worlds. Birds sing and mountain peaks are profoundly quiet. the roads in all four directions brighten with dawn. The six doorways are chill with autumn. Sharing the seed on the ground beyond doubt, a reflection of a bow floats in the wine cup. So the six doorways are chill with autumn. Any clues? Six? Six? Six, okay. Well, that's one way, yeah. What about six? Why would the six doorways be with our chill? Six doorways are chill with autumn. Mm-hmm. Six senses, the gateways, yeah, doorways.
We have
six. We have six. The mind is considered a sense in Buddhism. Six senses. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you need your mind to operate. This goes way back. John brought up like early Buddhism. Out of early Buddhism, after that was a period where Yogacara teachings flourished, and they talk a lot about the aspects of mind. And in there is the, looking back, even in the early sutras from the middle length discourses of the Buddha when he was on, walk the earth, they and the four foundations of mindfulness, there is the reference to the mind as one of the senses.
So what's the difference between six senses and five?
Well, we know what the five senses are. The sixth one is mind. Five skandhas are form, feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. And consciousness makes up the six. Because we consider eye consciousness, ear consciousness, mind consciousness, nose, smell, those, the five senses plus mind consciousness, all as consciousnesses. In the skandhas, form is the material, includes the material form, as well as, whereas the others are, non-material in the sense of formations are ideas, perceptions, we know what that is, right? Thoughts, feelings, we know what those are. So in the sense that form is like this body would be, but that's why it's the foundation for all these others. So it's stated first. Did I confuse you even more? Did I confuse you? No? Okay. All right. Any other questions? Maybe we need to chat.
Did you explain the passage about the six gateways in autumn?
Oh, the six gateways in autumn would be your senses, your six senses. So think about the roads in the four directions. We know what that is, right? North, south, east, or west, right? Brighten with dawn. The six doorways are chill with autumn. So it's a Dharma position of placing oneself present in a seasonal moment. Dogen is always very cognizant of inside and outside, and so he brings that to play in his writings. And because these Dharma Hall discourses were given, I want to say almost daily. When you have a volume like this, it's and these little things, these teachings were given to or presented to the monks. They'd come into the Dharma Hall standing, and Dogen would be at his seat and communicating these teachings. And then he'd finish, get down from the Dharma seat, they'd all walk out. Jiro has given me the silent bell. they'd come out of the Dharma hall and go into the meditation hall. So that's why he has something for every season. In his extensive record, you can see him marking the opening of the practice period, the opening of the furnace, the winter solstice. You know, so every season, every change, he includes in his teaching, again to bring the outside world in, to remind you where you are. So the six senses are to help you wake up to autumn. And today it was a little chilly, wouldn't you say? We knew that there was a change.
Could it also mean that, because this is in mystic poets have used this and yogis have used this a lot, your sense telephones and your meditation, your prana, your energy tends to withdraw through deep meditation and become interiorized, and that's where you have great awareness during meditation and the bliss. And so by saying, the six doorways are chill with autumn means, okay, we've all gone in now, the outside world, that's autumn or winter for now, for this moment, because the that's a typical mm-hmm. thing that the mystic poets mm-hmm. put in that kind of way.
Thank you. Okay, I think we need to chant out because lunch is ready. So, let's see. How does it go? May our intentions equally penetrate every being in place with the truth. Okay.